Thanks. I'm Charles, I'm an edic.
Hi, Charles.
Most times at meetings, you know when you're going to have to start speaking, but I haven't been to this meeting before, so I wasn't quite sure when the cue would come, which makes me a bit nervous. But it's okay, you know, I feel like I'm in the right place. I feel like I'm among friends, and I'm going to start at the end. I'm going to start at the end and then go back to the beginning and then come back to the end again. Because I just want to talk about this week. I buried a very close friend at the beginning of this week, and who I got clean with in 1987, and has been very ill for a long time. And I was very privileged to be able to become his friend and to get to know his family and to stay with him in the country where he was living, and and stuff that didn't happen to me when I was using, at the end of my using. I had no friends, and coming into this fellowship has opened up all these avenues for me, and the love that I found in it to be able to, to be sad and to grieve the loss of somebody, but at the same time to be joyful and grateful the fact that I've been given the opportunity to have friends that I didn't have before. So that was, that was sad. The other thing that happened this week was that, I've always shared that, which is true. I come from a family, a family with where this disease is very rife, and I come from a family which an upbringing which was very sort of no feeling, quite strict and detached and no feelings, and certainly the word love never really came into my dad's vocabulary. A bit in my mum's, but certainly not into my dad's vocabulary. And I got a telephone call. I got a telephone call from my younger sister this week saying, "Dad says, don't bother to get him anything that costs more than a fiver for Christmas. All he needs is love." And I thought, where the hell does that come from? And then I got a card from him the following day saying, with a normal bit that's written in the card, and lots of love added on to the sort of the bit that was already written in there. And so maybe, he's in his, well into his 80s, maybe something is changing, which would be great. Do I have to lean into this thing? Yes, probably. I've already got a sort of stiff neck. That's been my week. I feel really grateful to be here, and thanks for asking me, and thanks, Lisa, for your chair, which I really enjoyed. As I said, I come from a very dysfunctional family, a lot of addicts and people who married addicts and people who were addicts who I never met, like my grandparents who died of this disease. And I think about 4 years or so ago, when my brother's wife died of this illness, it was the first time in 30, 40 years that I've been alive that there wasn't any active addiction in my family. And it's been sort of quite a relief, but it's also been a very, even in throughout my recovery, it's still been very, very dysfunctional. Because there is that thing with my experience of the family where people are sort of in their sort of different factions trying to protect whoever it is that's using and try to sort of, put on this mask and stuff like that. So it was very difficult for the family to be close and get closer together. I began to get closer with my sister because she's in got clean at the same time as me and stuff, but not my brother. I'm 58 this weekend, and I spent a lot of my life in this fellowship. I got clean in my 30s, and I was going to say I've grown up in recovery, but at the same time, the other day I was just thinking, what do I want to do when I grow up? you know, I'm sort of, you know, part of the way there, I guess. You know. But anyway, you know, my story, my using bit of story is, I'm sure, is like very similar to everyone else's. You know, I started when I was a teenager. I used all drugs as much as I could, and for 17 years, and then ended up in a very desperate place. You know, that's my experience. I had some quite fun times. I lived in a broom cupboard in Bolivia. I was homeless for a while. I sold all my possessions, like we all do. I used to live in Hammersmith, and I would walk down to the local junk shop with a chest of drawers on my shoulders and sell it for a few pounds, even though it was worth, you know, being left to me by an aunt or something, and even though it was worth some money. My wife would come back later on in the day and say, "Where's that chest of drawers?" And I would say, "I've taken it to be restored." And that several days later, when it hadn't appeared, I had to sort of cop to it, I suppose. And that was sort of my history. And a lot of my history of using was selling all my possessions, all other people's possessions, all my going up to my parents' house in the country, selling a lot of their possessions. What happened to me at the end of my using? My sister, who's a year older than me, got clean. She'd been in prison for 5 years in Italy for smuggling, and she came back, carried on using, and at the end, I was the only person that she really communicated with, and vice versa. And you know, at the end, I was, I guess, friendless, penniless, homeless, and all the other lisses there are. And she went off and got clean, so I was even sort of more on my own. And I remember, you know, and it's good for me to remember this. I remember vividly the sort of that end period where I spent some time sharing a place with an alcoholic who had a very large methadone script and liked vodka. So I would go and steal the vodka, and he would give me the methadone. And we stayed in this place with the sort of the roof half caved in. And I remember lying there one day and thinking, I just want to be picked up, wrapped up in cotton wool, and rescued and put somewhere safe. You know, in a way, the sort of same sort of feeling as I had when I first had a hit of heroin. You know, that sort of warmth, no one can touch me, wrapped up in cotton wool. And I wanted that again. I had no idea where to find it, because I'd experienced some sort of the stuff that it talks about in the literature about, you know, where we go trying to find recovery. I'd been to a psychiatrist who told me it was my dad's fault. I went to a concept house where, in those days, I don't even know if they still exist, but certainly in those days, in the early 80s this was, rather than say, "I'm Charles, I'm an addict," you had to say things like, "I'm Charles, I'm an idiot." And it was about humiliation rather than, you know, anything else. And I think the concept was to knock you down and then build you up again and then teach you how to drink, which seemed a bit absurd, although I did stay there for a while out of sort of fear and a court case, you know, which was very useful. You know, I went there. But the concept did seem a bit strange, whereas I could have actually left earlier than I did and gone and had a drink, rather than have to stay there for 8 months to learn how to go and drink socially. So I left early, and I left in a sort of bigger mess than I was when I had arrived, having been stripped down to the bone and not gone through the process of being built up again. So I returned to the streets and carried on using. So that was my experience, and obviously methadone scripts at the local hospital and stuff like that, which towards the end, because I had to swap it with the guy with the vodka, I couldn't even get it together. I couldn't get stuff together. I couldn't get it together to sign on. At the end, I was wanted. You know, I thought, if I go anywhere where they're expecting me, I'll just be jumped on. And I just became, you know, a very, very lonely and, you know, unhappy person. Anyway, my sister got clean, and that's the first recollection once before. I went to a meeting. I did go to a meeting with a guy who I'd known all my life, who said, "Why don't you come to this meeting? A bunch of addicts all meet together in the Red Cross in Chelsea, and I make the tea for them. And why don't you come along?" And so I thought, well, that sounds quite interesting. I'll get stoned and then go along with him and see who he makes the tea for. And I went to this meeting, and the guy doing the share, I'd known from my, you know, I knew from my using before. I had no idea he'd got clean. And I don't know whether it made an impression on me immediately, because I wasn't, you know, particularly there, even though I was there in person. But that was my first recollection of NA, and I didn't go back after that. But when my sister got clean, obviously somebody I'd known all my life, I saw and met some of the friends that she was hanging out with, and saw that she had already, in a few weeks of recovery, had put on a bit of weight, had got a sense of humour back, was laughing, and just, you know, that sort of death mask from, you know, which is sort of on your face, had been lifted. And there was, basically what I'm saying is that I got some hope, you know. You know, I was at a place where I believe, you know, for me it was, the rock bottom, which enabled me to have some willingness to do something about where I was. You know, I was very unhappy. It was like, you know, do you kill yourself? Do you carry on? What do you do? Do you do this? I've tried that. What else do I do? I hadn't really got a clue, you know, where to go or what to do, because I tried what I knew. And, you know, so the willingness I had, I believe, mixed with the hope that I got from seeing my sister starting to get well, was what sort of propelled me towards recovery. You know, and it was very moving. You know, because we'd been pretty messed up for quite a few years in our family. You know, and we'd all been to prison, and both of us, and been shut out of the family house. You know, well, there was one point where I lived in a sort of annex at my mum's place, and she had locked all the doors between the main house and the annex, and just stuck the letters under the door, you know, so I could, you know, like an animal, you know. You know, so it was great to see her clean, you know. And I owe her, you know, I owe her my life in a way, you know, because that's the way, you know, I was attracted to NA through my sister. So I owe her a lot of gratitude, and I've told her that. So I followed her into recovery, and I remember, one of the things I always remember is when it was described to me about the illness concept, you know, the disease of addiction. I'd never really heard that before. I remember this huge weight being lifted off my shoulders, you know, this huge sense of relief, this dark cloud had been lifted, because I knew that underneath all this stuff, you know, this person I'd become, this animal living off on the street at the end of my using, I knew that underneath somewhere there was actually an okay person, you know, actually a quite nice, loving, caring, sensitive, cheerful, whatever, person, you know, it had once been there. And I couldn't understand how I'd got to that animal, you know, I couldn't understand what had happened. And, you know, and all the people around me who didn't understand anyway would just say, you know, pull your socks up, get a job, do all these things, and, you know, and get on with your life, you know, and didn't understand either. And that's what I thought. I thought I was just a sort of weak human being. But when I heard about the disease of addiction, it made sense. You know, it was a huge weight lifted, because I thought, yeah, okay, I'm prepared to accept that. You know, that it's an illness, that I'm responsible for my recovery. You know, maybe not that I'm responsible for everything I've done, because I've been sick. You know, and that was, that was fine. And I also remember laughing a lot. You know, I remember having been so sad and miserable for such a long time at the end of my using. I remember I went into a treatment place for a while. It's not necessary for everybody. You know, I know a lot of good friends who got clean in the rooms. For me, it seemed like a good idea. It seemed like that place where I was wrapped up in cotton wool and plonked somewhere safe out of the way for a bit. And I came across people who were in a similar position to me, you know, and were the same people I'd always sort of hung out with, but they were either clean or trying to get clean, or a few days clean or a few weeks clean, wherever we were in those days, you know. And I remember having this very, very fast detox from like, 100 to naught in 1 week, and thinking I would die, but... You know, it was okay. And I always share that. I always share that to people with the methadone thing, is that my experience was that the fear of coming off it at the end was always greater than the reality. You know, I was going to feel shit for a week or two afterwards, whatever happened. And, I did, and that was cool. But I just remember laughing and laughing, like belly laughing. And because it was just like, it was almost like, something inside of me was going, I finally come home, I don't have to do this anymore. That's what the nurse told me. She said, Charles, you never have to go through this ever again. And, I haven't since that day, since that time. Stayed clean, and I'm really grateful for that. I got, I did the stuff that was suggested. I didn't do all the stuff that was suggested. I did... a lot of the stuff that was suggested. I got involved in service. I got involved in the helpline. I got involved, very involved in hospitals and institutions. And I quite liked a title here and there, And I collected a few titles in my first few years of recovery, and around H&I in the office. In fact, I was called Office Charles for a while. Someone said to me the other day, "Are you still Office Charles?" I said, I don't think so. Many people have passed that way since. And, I remember the first time I did the helpline, I remember someone saying, "Just listen to me, what I do." And, because I was worried that I would say the wrong thing on my first telephone call. Listen to me, what I do. And really what it's like is like, it's like sharing with a newcomer at the end of the meeting. It's like you're just doing it on the telephone. And I remember the first time I did it, when an addict rang up from a phone box, really desperate and crying and sort of like, I need help, and immediately identifying with being that person in the phone box and needing that help, and able to sort of talk to him and identify with him over the phone, and suggest meet him and go to a meeting and stuff like that. And looking back on it, that's when I really experienced the art of keeping it by giving it away. You know, that whole thing of like getting myself out of my own selfishness and self-centeredness by trying to do something for somebody else. And I guess in a lot of ways, that's what I've tried to do that in my recovery. That's what I've learnt to do and try to continue to do, because it's good for me. You know, it keeps me clean. And it helps carry the message and all that sort of stuff. It works. I got a sponsor a bit late. I was looking for the perfect person, like we do sometimes. The same number of kids and the same age, wife or whatever. And I found a sponsor and started going through the steps. And I know... my experience these days, I've had young sponsees recently. I've just finished going through 12 steps with the youngest sponsee that I have, and very keen to sort of like do it really quickly. And in those days, I know that we were all pretty slow, pretty sluggish, I have to say. A step a year was sort of probably about average. But then I guess at the same time, it was like, you know, I mean, NA hadn't been going for that many years, and there weren't that many people to sort of to get, you know, to get the experience of, and we were sort of plonking away, you know, trying to pioneer ahead and sort of, you know, and trial and error, and you know, how do you do it? Well, let's just try it and see what happens, you know. So it worked. So maybe it's just gradually speeded up as we've gone through the years. I don't know. But you know, I was happy because I'm a bit slothful and a bit sluggish. So I, you know, I'm quite happy with a step a year or step every 6 months or something like that. Suits me. Anyway, I did it very thoroughly, and you know, I remember the first three. I mean, in a way, I was trying to look at the first three steps. Like, you know, I came into these rooms. You know, I said, "I'm Charles. I'm an addict. I surrendered," and I looked around. I listened to people, and people would suggest that, you know, if I kept coming back for 90 days, I could then make a decision about, you know, whether I wanted to go back to the misery that I had before, or whether I wanted to, you know, stay for another 90 days or whatever. And, you know, and sitting into each meeting of the first few weeks and months, and, you know, I got to see that other people and myself were being restored to sanity. You know, I could see that. And, you know, when it came to that point of having to make a decision to whether to hang around or not, you know, and sort of hand my will and my life over and all that, you know, it seemed like a pretty good idea. You know, it seemed like quite a reasonably easy choice because, you know, even in that short space of time, you know, I was happier. You know, I'd made some friends. And talking about, going back to what I was at the beginning, talking about friendship, you know, I one of the great things that really resonates with me, and, you know, I remember very, very deeply, and that is the contrast between the end of my using, when I had nothing and nobody wanted to know, and all the shutters were shut when you approached the front door of someone's house, and no one would answer your calls, and, you know, whatever, all that sort of stuff of total isolation. You know, you are, for whatever reason, you are bad news. You know, and then coming into this fellowship, where people said, "Welcome. Have a cup of tea, keep coming back, you know, we love you, there's a seat in this place for you," you know, and that contrast makes me quite emotional still today. That contrast was so attractive that, you know, that's a lot of the reason why I stayed, you know, I think, and kept coming back, you know, because it was very, very powerful, you know, being dismissed by everybody and then being accepted within a pretty short space of time. I hadn't really worked much in my using, as you don't. I've stolen a lot. I'd gone for the odd job just to shut people up or stop them throwing me out or whatever. And then, you know, it lasted half a day. I started when I got clean, selling hamburgers in the Olympia Crufts dog show, which was great. You know, it was great because I, you know, like you say, I didn't have any self-esteem, and I had no idea how to work. I had no idea how to turn up on time. I had no experience of having some wages and actually keeping them and not spending on drugs or anything like that. You know, so although it was long hours and shit pay, It's what I needed at the time. You know, it was something that suited my self-esteem at the time and gave me a little bit of self-esteem when I was doing it, you know, by turning up on time and actually being more responsible and conscientious than anyone else who was there, I tell you. Mm-hmm. And because we are, I find that, you know, addicts we stick to something and we say we do it, and we're pretty conscientious. And, you know, I had a few jobs in recovery. And then, you know, and I felt a bit more confident, and I had done some service, and I had some friends, and I thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, do a bit of a career thing. And one thing led to another, which often happens in recovery. You know, by chance, you end up somewhere where you had no idea you were going to end up. And I thought, I'm going to study law. And I had to fill in this form about my criminal record and my previous convictions and my using all that sort of stuff. And you would fill it out, and they say, "Well, what we normally do is we normally accept people or we don't accept them from the forms that you fill in. But normally, four people a year, we call up to the base and give them a grilling, see if we really want them." And I was one of those people. And I went up then. I went up then to this. It's like a dining room with loads of lawyers in it sitting around the table. I went in there and I did a chair, basically. Because I'd learned how to sort of be honest about myself, and the fact that if I was honest about what I was doing, that, I didn't have to sort of look behind me and I could hold my head up and all that sort of stuff. So I went in there and said, "This is me, blah, 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 what you see on that bit of paper, yeah, that's all true, I did all that, yeah, and more." And they said, "Leave the room," and then... I'll talk about you. And I came back in again, and they say, "Yeah, go for it. We'll support you and we'll back you through this, because we understand that was you then, and this is you now trying to do something about changing your life." And I was very touched, because in my head it was like, they're just thinking I'm a tosser and wasting their time. So I got a little bit more faith in humanity as well from that. So I went on, done that, and studied, and got fed up with studying, and studied a bit more, and I've been doing that ever since, basically. And I work in criminal law, and I come across all the people like myself on a daily basis, which is great, because it enables me to carry the message in a very sort of strange roundabout way. I have to be careful with an anonymity. On one hand, although as I get older, I don't care that much anymore. I think I'm not really important. It doesn't really matter. And I can sort of say, I've got a friend who's in recovery, and they go to NA meetings, and why don't you do this? And here's a leaflet and all that sort of stuff. I carry a few things around, so it's quite useful. And sometimes you see people in a cell, and then you see them in the room, so it's cool. I have had a lot of loss in recovery, particularly close friends. I don't know about you, but I'm not somebody who has a load of close friends. I've had a load of close friends. Lots of friends and lots of acquaintances and lots of people I nod to in meetings, and I've probably lost about 70% of them in my recovery. One story I always tell. Some people may have heard it, but it's important to me. The first guy I was close to, who died in recovery in the 90s, he was dying of emphysema in hospital. He was clean, and I got to know his daughter very well, and we'd see each other at the hospital and go out for a meal afterwards and stuff like that. And then he was going to have a transplant, and then it didn't happen, and then he died. And before he died, he said, "Will you look after, keep an eye on Sarah?" And I said, "Of course we will," because her mum had gone AWOL, left and gone to France years and years before, and no one had any idea where she was. And so I did, and I kept in touch with her. My wife and I kept in touch with her, and we had her around, and she had us around. And then a little while back, about a few years ago now, or 2 or 3 years ago now, she was her husband now asked her to be married, if she wanted to get married, and she called me and she said, "I'd like you to give me away at the wedding, because I haven't got a dad, and you've been very good to me, and I can't think of anybody I'd rather do it, and if you could give me away at the wedding and make a speech and all that sort of stuff for my dad, that would be great." And I was touched, and I thought, God, this is some of the stuff that happens. This is some of the sort of joyous stuff that happens from being clean and from gradually sort of growing up. And and I still, keep in touch. And I did. And I didn't know anybody there, because I didn't really know that part of the family and stuff like that. And I made this speech, and I remember that the best man made a very, very rude joke, and everyone just froze. It was like quite a sort of stiff upper lip type sort of bunch of people who were there. I felt very sorry for him. Anyway, so that was cool. And I've lost two friends in the last 2 months, and two or three more in this last few years, and I do have a problem with the grief, but that's my own stuff, because I find what happens, I kept losing people, and in the end I was just sort of like blocking it off and just sort of putting up a bit of a barrier. I thought, I can't feel this because there's another one, and so on. But like I said at the beginning, what is really nice about all that is that I have to keep reflecting back to the beginning when I didn't have any friends when I came into recovery. So to have some to lose is a great pleasure. What else? Yeah. So anyway, I'll go back to the steps for a couple of minutes. I did a very thorough full step and read it out with my sponsor in a monastery in Kent. And because we couldn't, it was myself and another sponsee of his, and we couldn't quite get to the end. And I was saying a step a year. This was actually 4 years, I think, the step four. And he said, "We've got to finish this, so we'll go to this monastery." Where we had a single room each, and we couldn't stop laughing. The same sort of laughter as I had when I was getting clean in this treatment centre, because we'd all left work from sort of buzzing London, driven down to this monastery, gone in. We arrived just in time for dinner, and all these monks, it was a complete silent dinner, with the fresh bread being baked in the oven and all that sort of stuff. And it was just the contrast of the sort of madness into this sort of quiet spiritual place was so insane. We just cracked up and finished the step four. And it was a big it was a big change, a big part, a big change in my life. Because I was I don't know about anyone else, but the therapeutic thing of like writing down stuff on paper and then looking at it and staring at it and saying, well, actually, that's me, that's my stuff, that's my behaviour. It makes it just that little bit difficult to carry on behaving in that way after that, And going on to step six and seven, it was like, what I try and do is to do the opposite, to try and do the opposite of the stuff that I would have done. For a long time, it was like acting as if, just sort of practicing doing the opposite, even though I didn't really feel like it, and then eventually it became easier to do in a way. I have times when I swear at the traffic and the stuff that gets me very angry and the stuff, and behave in a very sort of childish way. I can still, but at the same time, I think more often than not, I will slow down and let the guy coming in from the side road get in, because I'm not really in that much of a hurry. It's not really that important that I cut him up and piss him off, I guess I've realized recently that how important it is to still be in recovery. Because people say to me, "Are you still going to those meetings?" And all that sort of stuff. Aren't you better yet? And stuff's happened to me in the last year or two, which has taken me 24 years or something to actually to sort of sort out. Particularly some amends as well. Some amends of like, thing about, if you can't find the person or the thing, that you sort of become willing to do the amends and then just sort of let go and things happen. And years have passed, and two people have come through past me that I owed amends to that I had no idea where they were. One was at a funeral, of somebody I've known since the 70s. And suddenly this person appeared and I was able to do this amends. It's always an ongoing healing process, I guess. My first experience of... how long have we got?
5 minutes.
My first experience of amends was when I was talking about selling stuff when I lived in Hammersmith, down the local junk shop. There was also a shop there, which was run by somebody who's now quite a few years clean in recovery. I didn't know him, but I used to sell him odds and ends. And he's still there. And And I stole a oil painting off the wall of my mum's house in the Midlands, and brought it down to London, and on the Monday morning sold it to this bloke for about 15 quid. It's probably worth about 500 quid, but, you know, who was I to worry about that, as long as it was a hit? And one of the first meetings, when I came back to London, one of the first meetings I went to, I walked into this room, and there was this guy who I'd sold the picture to, and he remembered. And the next week, I came back to quite a nice meeting. I thought, I'll come back there the next week. So the next week, I came back to the meeting, and he brought the picture with him. And he'd stuck it, and he'd bought it, this was years before, and he'd stuck it on his wall upstairs, not put it in the shop, and gave it back to me. And then, so I was able to go back up to my mum's for the weekend and say, here's the picture. And then, only in this last year, I was just talking to somebody about something, and I thought, hang on a minute. I gave him, you know, he gave me some money for this picture. He kept the picture. He's given me the picture back. I've given the picture back to my mum. I owe him some money. You know, so it took me all that time to actually sort of clock that maybe I should make a little financial amends to him for that. You know, so it's sort of it's always happening. And the thing is, like someone else said, like Elisa, I think it's like, you know, a large percentage, you know, of the people I hang out with are in recovery, and I'm happy here, you know, and as I say, I've grown up from my 30s, my 40s, my 50s, and I'm thinking, people say, well, you're going to get a pension soon and all that sort of stuff. I said, no way, because I lost, you know, I didn't do anything for like 20 years or whatever, so I've got to carry on working till I'm 85, you know, but, you know, I feel good on it. I feel as though I probably left some stuff out, but, you know, it's probably coming to the end. So, you know, if you're new, if it's your first few meetings, then, you know, you're in the right place, you know. Hopefully, you know, you've got to a place like I did, which was like, I don't want any more of this misery. I need to be wrapped up somewhere and put somewhere safe and helped, and have people who will love me and look after me until I can look after myself, you know. And listen to some of the suggestions, even if you think they're a bit mad, because, you know, they've certainly done me well and kept me coming back. So I think that's probably about it. I'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
In any end, we celebrate clean time with keyrings, claps and hugs, and for that I'm going to pass it over to our speakers.
Lisa Maddox, is there anyone today or this week celebrating multiple years in recovery? Today or this week? 1 year clean and serene? 9 months? Hey. Anybody celebrating 6 months today or this week?
Oh, do the rest, please.
Okay.